Welcome to Techtopia, our segment on the technologies set to disrupt our future and some of the unexpected questions we may need to ask about them. Today, a technology we're all familiar with, our phone. It's gone from staid home-based handset to wearable message conveyor, music player, direction giver, and so much more. But how familiar are we with what our smartphones know about us and what they're doing with that information? Well, joining me in Sydney, as he does every week for Techtopia, is entrepreneur and technology author Steve Sammartino.
Hello, Eleanor.
Also here in our Sydney studio is Dr. Katina Michael, a professor at the School of Computing and Information Technology at the University of Wollongong, who's also on the board of the Australian Privacy Foundation.
Good to be with you.
Welcome to you both. Well, look, the phone is a technology that's just changing before our eyes. Today you can't escape the buzz over the launch of the latest version of one company's smartphone. But just to remind us how far this technology has come, have a listen to this from the mid-1950s, when the big innovation was switching from a manual to an automatic telephone exchange.
This conversation will be the last call connected through the central exchange to a central number.
Naturally, Mr. Fountain, I feel a tinge of sorrow in parting with my own telephone number, my old telephone number. However, we must progress with the times.
Progressing with the times. Now, of course, fixed phones are no longer our primary phones, even if anyone actually has them. The next big innovation was car phones. They've long since transformed into mobiles, then micro-mobiles, then smartphones, now phone watches. Steve, first to you, how much more change are we likely to see? I mean, are injectable phones far-fetched?
Oh, absolutely. The phone will enter our body. And the reason...
You mean it's not far-fetched?
No, not far-fetched at all. I mean, look at the trajectory that's happening now. Phones and computers were in big, giant rooms. They got smaller. They went onto desktops. And then they entered our pockets and then on our wrists. And then we have little wires going into our ears. And eventually those wires will go into our brains. And then that will be replaced with little injectable nanobots that become our communication devices. But what's really interesting is it's not a phone. We've got to stop calling it that. It's a globally interconnected supercomputer. I think it's almost our new neocortex, and that's why we feel so uncomfortable leaving the house without it, right? We need it. It's something that helps us participate in everything. And once we start calling it a supercomputer, then we'll understand its power and some of the repercussions if we misuse it or don't understand its power and what it can do.
Just for the purposes of this conversation, I'm going to keep calling it a phone. So, Katina, what do you think is next for the phone? I mean, do you agree with Steve that it could be implanted inside us?
Well, definitely it could be implanted within us. The jury's out, however, whether everyday citizens actually want to go that way. We're definitely set on a trajectory. I'm sure Silicon Valley would love to see us head towards the implantable PDA. I know when I was working at Norton Networks in 1997, we were already thinking about the obsolescence of the mobile phone towards something called brain-to-brain interface.
Good Lord.
So we are definitely going that way, yes.
So, Steve, we do tend to think of our mobile as our sort of personal device, and that it certainly has changed the way we run our social lives. But you look at the big picture on industrial disruption. How much disruption has the smartphone really driven in the broader economy?
Yeah, so it's done two things. It's done direct disruption and indirect. So I'll start with the indirect first. Because we've produced many billions of smartphones now, all of the components that go in there are actually incredibly cheap, cents on the dollar. And so other industries can jump on the coattails of that low production cost. So things like drone and the driverless car that we've already discussed, they're all possible because the technology is so widely produced at a mass consumer scale that it can be put into other industries. But also things like Uber, that can't happen without the smartphone. We'll see some massive disruption in healthcare and insurance because now all of our behavior is trackable. Our house will know what's in it. Our phone will know what we eat. It'll know how active we are. And so there are some other industries that will be disrupted because of what the phone knows. So it facilitates things.
Much of this is, of course, to do with how differently information is managed on smartphones. Now, Katina, it used to be that the only information conveyed via our phone was what we said directly with our voice. And of course, the location information given indirectly based on the fixed handset that we were calling from. How much more of ourselves do we now reveal through our phones?
Absolutely everything. It's an extension of ourselves, Eleanor. The average smartphone has about 14 sensors. These are little chipsets, things like accelerometers, gyroscopes, GPS location trackers, proximity sensors, environmental sensors, temperature sensors, even heart rate monitors and processors that tell the phone whether it's standalone or on a desk or moving very quickly. So it's all about how we use the phone. We use it to text, to call, but of course, more so now, we are driving location-based services through this. So our phone knows something called Uber valence, Steve. So it's not just Uber, add the valence in there. And Uber valence is knowing about who, where, and what condition you're in, and basically denoting what you're doing. It's predicting what you're doing. However, sometimes the context is missing.
That's right. And we can add to that, Eleanor, that with Siri on your phone, when you said yes to those terms and conditions that you didn't read, it actually is listening to everything you say. And the companies are suggesting that this is so the natural language processing can learn your voice and become more effective. But that data is stored somewhere. What if it gets in the wrong hands? It's listening to everything we say. This is real-time Gestapo.
So what could this data be used for?
Well, it can be used against you. And this is where I think the word privacy is interesting, because I don't think that privacy is the word that we should be using. It's discrimination. So if there's information about us and our belief systems and what we do, the long-term impact of privacy is actually future discrimination. And so we need to kind of get that on the radar so that people know what the potential repercussions are.
Now, Katina, before I get you to talk on the privacy issue, of course, this question about who uses our data breeds a sort of not unjustified fear of our phones. Just have a listen to this.
You know they can triangulate our location in like 25 seconds. You can buy a prepaid. Someone's going on a trip.
What?
Now, that's a little extract from the first season of the ABC drama The Code, which is now in its second season. Katina, what about wearable and possibly even... Actually, before I get to that, is it right that you can reveal your location in your phone in 25 seconds?
Even faster than that, yes, down to 10 metres of accuracy on average. And so who might be looking? Government might be looking through metadata in our telecommunications providers. Criminals who want to put malware and spyware and want to thieve on you can do that and cause harm by perhaps robbing your house when you're not home, and they can see that you're not home because you've just put a status update on Facebook through your phone's handset location GPS. Advertisers want to target you, and mostly I'm actually worried about advertisers and behavioural tracking and monitoring that's occurring without your... It's unauthorised, without your permission. And finally, family. Most of us would like to admit that, in fact, from the research we're doing, it's family members who are mostly snooping on your privacy, siblings, parents, surveilling, and usually surveillance is a local issue. So we're moving from the big brother government, you know, they're watching, to the companies are watching, and I can mention quite a few tech giants, right down to who is doing that in your household or in your workplace.
Well, we just heard there someone trying to throw their phone away so that it, you know, that danger is gone. But what about wearable and, you know, you've been talking about the possibility of injectable phones. I mean, will they be able to track us in new ways, or is it just that we're less likely to be able to be easily separated from them?
So in the Internet of Things discussion that we're having, the individual will be that lowest common denominator. That implant within the body will require some kind of proximity sensor, RFID or NFC device that can read or be tethered to a tablet or some other infrastructure. You know, imagine going through a tollway that's electronic. There's a discrete entry-exit point, your Opal card as you enter and leave the train station. So it doesn't have to be continuous tracking. We've got predictive monitoring. But the thing is, while on the one hand, Eleanor, we think we can leave all these wires behind, we don't have to have PowerPoints, we don't need batteries. On the other side, it's an enslavement of the mind. And once we allow technology to enter the body, piercing the skin, transferring down to the subdermal layer, then what we're actually doing is losing a bit of control, and control is that underlying function. Yes, it's convenient. Yes, it's care solutions, but it's all about control.
Steve, Katina mentioned there that we're giving away information without our knowledge. I mean, is that really right? Because, you know, you put an app on your phone, you know it's a location app. You know that your phone is able to tell what music you like listening to. I mean, what information do we give away that is unauthorised?
Okay, so most of the sensors that we speak of, that Katina mentioned here, most of those work when we're not interacting with the phone. So most of the population believe that the information that they give away is what they put into the phone, when they get messages, the websites they surf and that type of thing, the photos that they take. But what they don't realise is that a lot of things are happening even when the phone's off. So the GPS works when the phone's off. Next time you do a flight, put it in flight mode and you can actually watch as you're flying. So a lot of these sensors work when the phone's not on. I could tell with anyone's phone when they go to bed and when they wake up based on the gyrometer and when it moves next to the bed, when they stop reading and finally fall asleep. So people just aren't aware of the data that are outside of your interactions that it tracks, and that can provide a lot of information.
Katina, you do a lot of research on privacy. Are you personally worried about what your phone collects? Do you even, are you worried so much that you don't own one?
I do own a smartphone, but my husband doesn't, and a lot of my colleagues don't either, especially civil libertarians, privacy advocates. If they do own a smartphone, in fact, they turn off all the features and they just use the telephone, but most of them have the old flip phones, and they seem not to be IP enabled, which is what most people are worried about, that spyware that can actually access your camera on your phone without you realizing, without the blue light going on, when the audio sensor is triggered on a motion detection, without you seeing or hearing a ringing sound. All of these things can happen through malware. And it's basically, I would suggest, go to trusted sites to download those apps that you want on your phone.
I must say I find it rather alarming that big data specialists say they don't want to own smartphones, precisely because they don't want that information exposed. I mean, if the scientists who really know how this works are reluctant to take part in this revolution, should we all be more wary?
We definitely should be, and I can say that probably in the next 2 years, after I give up my admin role, I will let go of one of these.
Well, you know what the challenge is that without the smartphone, you almost cannot participate in the economy, right? It's a necessity, right? And so what we need to do is the cat's out of the bag in terms of tracking. So we need to civilize the technology, just like we did in the industrial era. We had factories where people were getting injured and hurt. And so we instituted workplace health and safety. We need the same thing. We need like a Magna Carta for the internet. And that's what Sir Tim Berners-Lee has said. So we need almost like, you know, a valid set of terms and conditions that all companies use, and then the company can tell us what their exceptions are. Terms and conditions that aren't 20,000 words or 56 pages like iTunes is, that we can understand in human terms so we know what we're dealing with. So we need to civilize the technology so that we can all embrace its economic power.
That's a great goal, but of course in the internet age it's very hard to police. Now, Katina, you would know about that. How do you deal with privacy when something like, you know, is so huge like that?
I think you start really small and you look at your smartphone and you say, which apps do I really require on there? You also look at turning off applications that come pre-installed and look at the privacy settings. Very simply, turn off that location tracker or just use it on particular applications. Don't take too many photographs and post them to the web because they have metadata related to them when that location setting is enabled, and only a fifth of us take off that location feature. However, it's useful for navigation, for example. I would say more than 50% of us don't install apps that really log on to personal information. So if you get that trigger alert that says so-and-so app wants to access your audio, your camera, your everything under the sun, just
say no. I think
they'd
probably be aware of that, but you're saying there's a lot that don't give us that alert.
That's right.
So how does Australia compare to the rest of the world when it comes to laws to protect privacy on this issue?
We're very patched at the moment. I mean, we've seen amendments to the Privacy Act. There's been issues with trans-border flows. There's a whole host of issues to do with surveillance devices and the Surveillance Devices Act in different states. So at different levels and at different states, we have a mismatch of different laws that apply. And of course, that law which has now been changed, the Telecommunications Act, which allows for the metadata to be stored for up to 2 years. So everything we do with that device, every single search we do, every single voice-activated search we do using Google or Siri or whatever else is actually stored.
Steve, in the US, you actually have to pay to have your privacy protected as well. I mean, is that legitimate?
I think it's illegitimate. It should be the other way around. I actually think that companies should have to pay to have access to your data, and you should be the first one that gets the ability to sell the information that you've provided. It's like your content. There should be a copyright around it where you get rewarded for what you create for these organisations. And, you know, that's an issue that needs to be faced at the macro lobbying level, because these companies now, five of the world's biggest companies are tech companies. And so that tells us how important this is. So I think that there needs to be a reversal in terms of who the beneficiaries are on the content that is created.
Just very briefly back to you, Katina, is that data asymmetry something that we can address with laws?
We can try. We can definitely do better with our current existing privacy principles. What you just said, Steve, was the tech companies are the five biggest companies. Amazingly, they're also our five biggest health insurers. So I want the public to basically look at how things like our health and sensor-based data on how many steps we do per day is going to be used for setting health premiums in the future. And that's my biggest worry.
Yeah, it's a big worry, because it's certainly with insurance too. If you have this discrimination, then the business model becomes one where people become uninsurable. And so that's that discrimination thing that I mentioned earlier becomes a massive issue.
Well, that's it for Techtopia. Thanks so much for our guests, Steve Sammartino and Dr. Katina Michael. You've given us some things to deeply worry us, I think.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And today's discussion will be available on the World Today website and as a podcast. Next Thursday, we'll be taking a look at artificial intelligence.